Heathrow on Sunday morning looked like one of those bad science fiction movies, set in the near future after the security forces have taken over the state. Two armoured personnel carriers were parked outside the terminal. Vast lines of passengers queued to be frisked and x-rayed, carrying their shoes in one hand and their pathetic toiletries in a clear plastic bag in the other. A satellite news channel was burbling away in the corner of the American Airlines lounge. No one was watching. I fixed myself a double espresso and was just turning to the football reports in one of the tabloids when I heard the words Adam Lang. 3 days earlier, I would have taken no notice. But now it was as if my own name was being called out. I went and stood in front of the screen and tried to make sense of the story. To begin with, it sounded like old news. Four British citizens had been picked up in Pakistan a few years back, kidnapped by the CIA, according to their lawyer, taken to a secret military installation in Eastern Europe and tortured. The new twist, apparently, was that a Sunday paper had obtained a leaked Ministry of Defence document which seemed to suggest that Lang had ordered an SAS unit to seize the men and hand them over to the CIA. Various expressions of outrage followed. A spokeswoman for Lang was quoted as saying the former Prime Minister knew nothing of the reports and was refusing to comment. A short time later, they announced the Boston flight was boarding. I love that moment when a grab dray landscape flickers out of sight beneath you and the plane tunnels up through the clouds to burst into the sunshine. I had a drink, I watched a movie, I dozed for a while. But I must admit, I also scoured that business class cabin for every Sunday newspaper I could find, ignored the sports pages for once, and read all that had been written about Adam Lang and those four suspected terrorists. We made our final approach to Logan Airport at 1 PM local time. As we came in low over Boston Harbour, the sun we had been chasing all day struck the downtown skyscrapers one after the other, erupting columns of white and blue, gold and silver, a firework display in glass and steel. When I was through immigration, I turned on my phone. It showed a welcoming message from Lang's personal assistant, someone named Amelia Bly, apologising for not providing a driver to collect me from the airport. Instead, she suggested I take a bus to the ferry terminal at Woods Hole and promised a car would meet me when I landed at Martha's Vineyard. We came into the ferry terminal at Vineyard Haven just before 7. By then, I'd been travelling for 17 hours. I didn't know where I was or which landscape I was passing through. The taxi driver didn't utter a word the whole journey, just scrutinised me in the mirror. I could see nothing except my reflection in the cold darkness of the window. After a while, we turned left into what I guessed must be Edgartown. And not long after that, we pulled up outside the Lighthouse View Hotel. I can picture the scene in summer. Buckets and spades and fishing nets on the veranda. Sandals by the door. A dusting of white sand trailed up from the beach. But out of season, the big old wooden hotel creaked in the wind like a sailing boat stuck on a reef. Inside, a girl dressed up as a Victorian maid handed me a message from Lang's office. I would be picked up at 10 the next morning and should bring my passport to show security. I was starting to feel like a man on a mystery tour. As soon as I reached one location, I was given a fresh set of instructions to proceed to the next. The taxi driver picked me up from the hotel next morning. Because I'd been booked into a hotel in Edgartown, I'd assumed that Reinhardt's property must be somewhere in the port itself. Instead, we drove out of town for about 10 minutes into flat, thickly wooded country. And then, before I'd even noticed a gap in the trees, swung left down an unmade sandy track until we came to a closed gate, and there materialised a man carrying a clipboard and wearing the unmistakable dark Crombie overcoat and polished black Oxfords of a British plainclothes copper. I wound down my window and handed him my passport. He scowled as he checked my name against the list on his clipboard. Then the gate swung clear, the track curved, and we drew up at the house. From somewhere inside, I heard a door slam, and an elegant blonde in a dark blue jacket and skirt, carrying an A4 black and red hardcover notebook, came clicking down the corridor on high heels. "Amelia Bly," she said with a fixed smile. I presumed she was the spokeswoman mentioned in that morning's Times. Adam's in New York, unfortunately, and won't be back till later this afternoon. Come and have a cup of coffee. I'll show you where we work. I followed her into the interior, trailing in her cloud of scent. She had very nice legs, I noticed, as she walked. The house was arranged so that all the bedrooms were on the ground floor, with the living space above. And the moment we ascended into the huge open sitting room, I understood why. The wall facing the coast was entirely made of glass. There was nothing man-made within sight, just ocean, lake, and sky. "We're in here," said Amelia, opening a door. She produced a key from the pocket of her well-cut jacket and unlocked a big gunmetal filing cabinet from which she withdrew a box file. "This is not to be removed from this room," she said, laying it on the desk. "It's not to be copied. You can make notes. But I must remind you that you've signed a confidentiality agreement. You have 6 hours to read it before Adam gets in from New York." All good books are different, but all bad books are exactly the same. And what they all have in common is that they don't ring true. I'm not saying that a good book is true, necessarily, just that it feels true for the time you're reading it. Adam Lang's memoir failed the test. It consisted of 16 chapters arranged chronologically, early years, into politics, challenge for the leadership, and so on. Each chapter was between 10 and 20,000 words long and hadn't been written so much as bolted together from speeches, official minutes, communiques, memoranda, interview transcripts, office diaries, party manifestos, and newspaper articles. Occasionally, Lang permitted himself a private emotion or a personal observation, but not very often, and not to any great effect. And where was his wife? I wondered. She was barely mentioned. It was strictly accurate, and yet overall, it was a lie. It had to be, I thought. No human being could pass through life and feel so little. Especially Adam Lang, whose political stock in trade was emotional empathy. No wonder Macara had thrown himself off the Martha's Vineyard ferry. No wonder Maddox and Kroll had flown to London to try to rescue the project. No wonder they were paying me $50,000 a week. All these seemingly bizarre events were rendered entirely logical by the direness of the manuscript. I took a gulp, literally and metaphorically, and began reading again from the top. I finished the last of the 621 pages in mid-afternoon, and when I laid down the manuscript, I pressed my hands to my cheeks and opened my mouth and eyes wide in a reasonable imitation of Edvard Munch's The Scream. That was when I heard a cough in the doorway. I looked up to see Ruth Lang watching me. "As bad as that," she said. She was wearing a man's thick, shapeless white sweater, so long in the sleeves that only her chewed fingernails were visible. And once we got downstairs, she pulled on top of this a pale blue cagoule, disappearing for a while as she tugged it over her head. Her short, dark hair stuck up in Medusa's spikes. It was she who had proposed a walk. She said I looked as though I needed one, which was true enough. She found me her husband's windproof jacket and a pair of boots belonging to the house, and together we stepped out into the blustery Atlantic air. "So how bad is it?" she said. "You haven't read it." "Not all of it." "Well," I said politely, "it needs some work." She had pulled up her hood. I couldn't really see her face, only the sharp white tip of her nose was visible. Everyone said she was smarter than her husband and that she'd loved their life at the top even more than he had. Now she stopped and turned to face the ocean, her hands thrust deep into her pockets. "You were my idea," she said. "I was?" "Yes, you wrote Christie's book for him." It took me a moment to work out who she meant. Christie Costello, I hadn't thought of him in a long while. He was my first bestseller. The intimate memoirs of a 70s rock star. "You know Christie?" It seemed so unlikely. "Oh, we stayed at his house on Mustique last winter. I read his memoirs. They were by the bed. And now I'm embarrassed." "No, why? They were brilliant, in a horrible kind of way. Listening to his scrambled stories over dinner and then seeing how you'd turn them into something resembling a life. I said to Adam then, this is the man you need to write your book." She pulled back her hood and took a deep breath. She was better looking in the flesh than she was on television. The camera hated her almost as much as it loved her husband. It didn't catch her amused alertness, the animation of her face. "God, I miss home," she said. "I keep telling him it's like being married to Napoleon on St. Helena." "Well, then why don't you go back to London?" She didn't say anything for a while, just stared at the ocean, biting her lip. Then she looked at me, sizing me up. "You did sign that confidentiality agreement?" "Of course. Because I don't want to read about this in some gossip column next week." "Whoa," I said, "I thought you just said I was your idea. I didn't ask to come here." She nodded. "All right. Then I'll tell you why I can't go home. Between you and me. Because there's something not quite right with him at the moment. And I'm a bit afraid to leave him." Boy, I thought, this just gets better and better. "Yes," I replied diplomatically. "Amelia told me he was very upset by Mike's death." "Oh, she did she? Quite when Mrs. Bly became such an expert about my husband's emotional state, I'm not sure." If she had hissed and sprung claws, she couldn't have made her feelings plainer. "No, it isn't just that. It's losing power. That's the real trouble. Losing power, and now having to sit down and relive everything year by year. While all the time the press are going on and on about what he did and didn't do. He can't get free of the past, you see. He can't move on." She gestured helplessly at the sea, the sand, the dunes. "He's stuck. We're both stuck." As we walked back to the house, she put her arm through mine. "Oh, dear," she said, "you must be starting to wonder what you've let yourself in for." There was a lot more activity in the compound when we got back. A dark green Jaguar limousine with a Washington license plate was parked at the entrance, and a black minivan with darkened windows was drawn up behind it. As the front door opened, I could hear several telephones ringing at once. A genial, grey-haired man was sitting just inside, drinking a cup of tea, talking to one of the police guards. He jumped up smartly when he saw Ruth Lang. "Afternoon, ma'am." "Hello, Jeff. How was New York?" "Bloody chaos, as usual. Like Piccadilly Circus in the rush hour. Thought for a while I wouldn't get back in time." Ruth turned to me. "They like to have the car in position when Adam lands." She began the long process of wriggling out of her cagoule, just as Amelia Bly came round the corner, a cell phone wedged between her elegant shoulder and her sculpted chin. "That's fine, that's fine. I'll tell him." She nodded to Ruth and carried on speaking. "On Thursday he's in Chicago." Then looked at Jeff and tapped her wristwatch. "Actually, I think I'll go to the airport," said Ruth, suddenly pulling her cagoule back down. "Amelia can stay here and polish her nails or something. Why don't you come?" she added to me. "He's keen to meet you."